2 weeks ago, I gave an introduction to the topic of the hindrances, the five hindrances. The five hindrances are very key to what the Buddha had to say about meditation, that meditation really begins to kick in, or can really kind of have a life of its own, a very deep kind of level of concentration and mindfulness and insight. Once the hindrances have been put aside, once a person's not in the grips of the hindrances. And the hindrances are those psychic forces which make it very hard to be present. So when they're operating, people tend to get not so present. They're lost in their thoughts or in their feelings and their concerns. And so it makes a lot of sense then that somehow if we're going to want to be really present and get deeply absorbed or deeply insightful, that we have to somehow come to terms with these five hindrances, these five forces, so they no longer hinder our ability to be fully present. So they're very important to understand. The five hindrances, for those of you who weren't there 2 weeks ago, I'll list them. They are sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, it's the third one. The fourth one is restlessness and anxiety. And the fifth one is doubt. So over the next few weeks, I'm going to go through each of those five and talk about them. And today's is the day for desire. So, sensual desire. The Pali, for those of you who care, is kamachanda. Kama is, like Kama Sutta, Kama Sutra. It's the same word, kama. So it can have a very strong word in Indian languages. It is a strong word. And in the Buddhist context, it generally means sensual desire or sensual pleasure. It's kind of interchangeable, those two, as far as I understand. And to begin the discussion of this, I thought I'd tell you a little event that happened to me when I was practicing in Burma. Pretty much every day I would go have an interview with my teacher in this little house. And I'd walk in and he'd be sitting. It was basically this big room. You walk into this big room and he'd be sitting in a chair and walk in and sit down and have an interview. And one day, after I'd been practicing for some months and my mindfulness was quite strong, my concentration was fairly good, so I was able to track things very kind of precisely as things unfolded in the present moment. It's kind of like having a magnifying glass at my own reactions and responses. And I walked in through his door into his room. And I looked over to my right on his altar. He had a small altar. And there I saw there was a wooden Buddha, Burmese Buddha statue, that usually wasn't there. I'd never been there before, first time I saw it. So I turned and I saw it. The next instant, I was aware of seeing the Buddha, and it was an instant of pleasure, because it was quite a beautiful Buddha. And I saw pleasure arose in my mind. And on the heels of pleasure was, I want that. And it was kind of eye-opening for me because in seeing that sequence happen, usually I would have just wanted it. I would have seen it and I went, that's great, I'd like that. But I saw how the wanting was conditioned on the pleasure that I got in seeing it. Now, if I hadn't been quick to notice that, what I could easily imagine, in other circumstances, I'm sure this has happened for me, where I want something based on the pleasure it gives me, but I don't see the instant of pleasure. But I know I want it. And then I'll rationalize why I want it. A Buddha statue would be great, it would inspire me to get enlightened, I'd have it in my altar, it would be really meaningful for me in my own spiritual life, and you know, I'd go on all kinds of wonderful, rational, really good reasons why it would be good to have whatever I want. But and then the rationale gets confused for the original impulse. The impulse was simply, I wanted more of that very simple pleasure. So the movement towards pleasure and wanting more is a very common phenomenon for human beings. I'm sure all of you have had experiences of it. So then another story, which people who do a lot of meditation on retreats, probably a lot of people can share this little story, where you're sitting in meditation, the motivation to practice is quite strong. It's a central, maybe at least for the time being of the retreat, maybe for the person's life in general. Primary value, primary importance, primary motivation is to practice deeply and well. There's something about that spiritual practice they're really on fire to kind of pursue and go after and do. Beautiful motivation, great inspiration, great aspiration operating. Perhaps the person has put aside a lot of things, maybe sacrificed a lot of things, in order to be able to be on that retreat, and now they're finally kind of applying themselves. They wanted for years to really do this, and they're really, really doing well. They're chugging along. And they're sitting there meditating, and in the more dramatic forms of the story, the person is feeling like they're on the verge of enlightenment. Things are going so well. You know, this is it. You know, just any moment's going to happen. And then the lunch bell rings. And then the desire for lunch arises. This is the pleasure of lunch. Forget about enlightenment. Suddenly that's become not so important. All this tremendous aspiration and wish to really practice deep, you know, lunch is more important. You know, lunch could wait 10, 15 minutes while you get enlightened, but, you know, it's like now. A person can have very powerful aspiration, something is a motivation for their life, and then be derailed by sensual desire, wanting a comfort or pleasure in some way. And I'm sure you all have your own story of how that's happened in your life. It can happen just as simple as, sometimes very innocent, it's very nice, some of the pleasures we can have, but they can derail deeper motivations, deeper wishes we have for what we want to do with our lives. It can be as innocent as, lingering in bed longer because it's a cold morning and it's really warm there and so cozy and just really nice to be there and lay there. And the consequences might be that you feel harried and rushed as soon as you do get up because you have to get everything ready and out the door and to work. And you realize the consequence, the cost, you probably wouldn't, if you really took in the cost, you might not want to linger there, but that's so nice, just we hold on. Now this operates when the Buddha talked about the five hindrances, he talked about it in relationship to meditation practice. It applies to elsewhere in our lives, but if we kind of limit it now just to meditation practice, what we're trying to do in meditation is to be engaged, be present for what's happening. And as the mind gets pulled into wanting sensual pleasure, it's actually usually leaves the present moment a little bit. Sometimes it's very clear it does that because the pleasure is not happening right now. And so it becomes entering into the world of thought, into the world of projecting into the future, what we want in the future. And we get mesmerized by that wanting, by that thought, by that fantasy, and we get pulled into it. Sometimes in meditation practice it can be quite strong, where there can be a very strong fantasy of desire, what we want, some pleasure, and it's so captivating that we just fall into this fantasy for minutes, hours, days. It can be sexual fantasy, it can be fantasies about vacations, it can be fantasies about food, it can be fantasies about all kinds of things. It can be fantasies about how you want to have a really wonderful meditation experience. You're engineering, fantasizing what it'd be like if you really could be filled with bliss instead of knee pain. And sometimes desire fantasies are very pleasant in and of themselves. So the allure is not the imagination of the pleasure that's going to come, but the hook is the pleasure that's right there in the fantasy. It's so pleasant. And so there we go, kind of the mind, oh, I'll go there. And I've known some people who've actually come to me and said in an interview, talking about their meditation practice, and said, I had a kind of a hard morning and I felt like I deserved to spend the afternoon in fantasy. I kind of like take a break and rest after a while. It was actually a choice. It wasn't just simply kind of being, unconsciously hooked. There was a choice made. I'm going to go there and get, for my comfort. I've known people in meditation who have a very, all of us, but I shouldn't say some people, all of us, who have some degree, some attachment to comfort. And that attachment to comfort makes it very hard for them, or willing for them, to stay present when things are uncomfortable. Sometimes that desire for comfort comes along with a belief that a successful human life is one that's comfortable, when there's pleasure. And if there's some discomfort, it's a symptom or a sign that something is amiss with me. I haven't made the right choices, or the retreat center is the wrong retreat center, or it's the wrong practice, or kind of be judging something outside as being amiss. Because if things were really right, there would be a lot of pleasure or a lot of comfort. And so that belief then kind of makes the mind kind of reactive. It pulled into the world of desire in some way or other. Sometimes in meditation there can be a lot of pleasure. And this is one of the paradoxes around pleasure, is that sensual pleasure can be an obstacle to going deep in meditation. But going deep in meditation is one of the most sensually pleasurable things a person can do. So it's kind of like sometimes it's a matter of kind of sacrificing this really deep possibility of, you know, sensual pleasure that comes with meditation for something that's much more kind of superficial or you know, less, you know, juicy. But then sometimes because meditation can be pleasurable, sometimes people get attached to it and they hold on to it. And that holding on then prevents a person to really connect more deeply with the present moment, to really be full here or awake to what's going on now. Attachment constricts or contracts the mind or the heart. And the movement towards freedom is one of opening it up. So as soon as the mind latches on to a desire, it's lost its freedom. So it's very common for people to say, well, what's wrong with sensual pleasure? When we talk about the hindrance of sensual pleasure. And sometimes you read Buddhist texts, and it seems like the Buddhists, some of these Buddhist, early Buddhist texts, they're just party poopers. You know, they talk about the dangers of sensual pleasure and renouncing sensual pleasures, and sensual pleasures are the enemy. And I mean, it's pretty, language can be pretty strong. And then people, what's wrong with sensual pleasure? There is nothing inherently wrong with sensual pleasure, and you're not expected not to have it anymore or to push it away. But when a person is trying to meditate, or a person is trying to follow through on some very deep intention and motivation in their life, and sensual pleasure keeps derailing them, then they have to come to terms with that sensual pleasure. They have to kind of somehow deal with it so that it no longer gets in the way, no longer derails them. When we sit in meditation, even the most innocent form of sensual pleasure can be a very simple derailment from this razor's edge of the present moment. And so people who meditate a lot have to be very keenly attentive to how the mind slips off that edge into the past, into the future, into fantasy. So if meditators are constantly dealing with it, maybe you can forgive them a little bit for sometimes talking very strong, having strong language about the sensual desire. You know, it's the enemy or the problem. But it's still something you have to deal with and negotiate. There's a teaching from the Buddha where he talked about if you have a white cloth that's completely soiled, completely dirty, and if you throw a little bit more stain on it, dirt on it, you can hardly tell because it's so dirty already. But if you clean it, get it all white and bleached and all white and clean, then if you put a stain on it, it's noticed right away. It becomes a big deal. When the mind gets purer and purer, stiller and stiller, more and more free in meditation or in any kind of situation, we tend to notice the consequences of attachments, even very subtle ones, in ways we wouldn't if the mind is really busy and kind of caught up in attachments. There's a saying that we are so distracted by distractions, we don't even know we're distracted. We can be so caught up in attachments that it kind of blinds us from really realizing the cost of being attached, being gripped, in the grip, being addicted. So as the mind gets stiller, calmer, freer, it tends to be increasingly sensitive to things that are not a big deal in daily life. But as you try to gain closer and closer to that moment of freedom or that moment of being open, it becomes a bigger and bigger deal for the psyche. And so we have to learn how to recognize this hindrance of sensual desire. Not sensual desire, but the way that sensual desire can be hindrance by the way we get caught by it, get pulled into its allure and world. Now, outside of meditation, and sensual desire can be a huge issue. Sometimes sensual desire, and I don't think some people realize the tremendous power of sensual desire, because it's derailed their life. People who have addiction issues in their lives, sometimes their lives are ruined because of their addiction. At the root, a desire for comfort and pleasure. Confusion sometimes that pleasure is happiness. And so the pursuit of some kind of pleasure that comes from some kind of addiction is trying to fill some deep need for happiness or well-being or, you know, something that's lacking. And it's ruined many lives. It can ruin friendships. For example, if sexual desire, just the desire for pleasure sexually. Jack Kornfield likes to ask a show of hands, who here has not made a fool of themselves with their sexuality? So I'm not asking you to raise your hands, but usually when Jack asks, who hasn't made a fool of themselves with their sexuality? No one dares raise their hand. And so I don't know, maybe, the one or two people for whom it's the case, they're embarrassed to say, in any case, the desire for sexual pleasure sometimes can cause, huge devastating problems in marriages and all kinds of places. And sometimes at the root of it is simply a desire for pleasure. There can be other motivations going on, but sometimes just that simple. And there's many, many kinds of sensual pleasure. An interesting one for a few people is the pleasure of their intellect. And some people find their intellect, their problem-solving capacity of their mind, their capacity of the mind to think and imagine and solve problems, is so pleasant, so pleasure-seeking, that it can seem like a grand thing they're doing, but they're simply pursuing that because it brings them pleasure. The pleasure is the motivation. So it doesn't have to be sexual pleasure or, the pleasure for food, but it can be other things too, that, like intellectual pleasure. That's where we get grabbed and hooked. And I've known a couple of people whom it's been very hard for them to meditate because the pleasure hook that they have is in the intellect, thinking and imagining and kind of solving problems and analyzing. And it brings them a lot of pleasure, and that's where they go. The pull or the attachment to desire, to sensual pleasure, has a cost, can have a cost. And some of the costs are, for example, there can be the cost of exhaustion. I've been in the grips of various kinds of desires for sensual pleasure, and when I kind of finally came out of it, I found myself exhausted and tired. A small example is, used to be when I was quite a bit younger, I loved going into bookstores. And I noticed when I left the bookstore, I was wiped out. It's because I wanted all those books. I would go see title. Oh, I like that. But I didn't have any money when I was young, so I couldn't buy them. It didn't make any sense to buy all these books. I couldn't even carry them out. I wasn't strong enough. Just that wanting. I didn't even know that I was wanting so much, but just wanting. That's the good. I like that, And I've known people who have gone to IKEA and left exhausted. Now, I don't know all the causes and conditions for that, but I wonder if it's a little bit the same thing. Kind of like, should I get this? Should I get that? This one, that one? It's kind of the desire operating. There can be a tension around desire. It can be very strong, can be very subtle. Sometimes desire is appropriate to pursue, sometimes it's not. And that tension can be a tremendous cost on the human being. Sometimes desire can be alienating. If we pursue desire too much, we certainly alienate ourselves from the present moment. Usually desire has to do about something that's not present. It can be, something that may be in the future, a few seconds or a few minutes or a few hours, and to be caught up in the future thinking. Or to hold on to a pleasure that's here doesn't allow us to kind of be flexible enough to see how things are changing, to be open to what's happening. So there's kind of an alienation that can happen. And some people who are really in the grips of strong desire find themselves very alienated, sometimes from themselves. If the attachment is towards something external, and we're consumed with that external thing over and over again, then kind of lose touch with ourselves. Desire can also keep us on the surface of life. It kind of can be kind of superficial. Sometimes when we want some, I mean, sensual pleasure, as wonderful as it is, is not that profound. It's pointed out often that sensual pleasure can be quite brief. And in some situations, the results, the consequences are forever. You know, take a long time to repair, you know. And things that bring happiness can bring a lot longer satisfaction than sensual pleasure. And so the fleeting kind of lure of sensual pleasure that's going to do something for us, can be very temporary. So it keeps us on the surface, sometimes away from some depth of subjective experience, some ability to really feel something deeply and subjectively, depth of who we are. Desire can lead to poor judgment. And sometimes that grip, you know, we don't see things clearly, and we make choices we'd rather not have made. Going shopping and coming home with something that you hadn't intended to buy. This is one small example that some people have. It's very interesting to look at this issue of how we rationalize the desires. Because I think often people can make, I mean, often, sometimes people make huge philosophies that can have a lot of good reasons why we want to do something, when at the source, it's just simply desire. But those rationalizations sometimes are based on a poor judgment. They're trying to fit our life, or try to explain a reason, when the real reason is different from the rationalization. So I've known people who have very good kind of minds for rationalizing, will argue their case really good, and you get the sense that they can argue anything. They take any position at all, but what's really at the source of motivating them is they want their pleasure. They want things their way. And so they'll argue it whatever way it is, but that's the very simple source, is amoeba-like movement towards desire, to wanting things. Now, part of what things that gives desire strength is that it is sometimes hooked or linked to other forces, needs in our psyche. So I saw this once many years ago when I was hitchhiking in Denmark. And this Dane picked me up and he asked me, you know, what I wanted to do or something, my life or something. And I started telling him, I went through a list of all the things I wanted to do. I wanted to practice Zen. I wanted to study Sufism. I wanted to study Aikido. I was going to do yoga. I wanted to study organic farming. I kind of going through his litany of all these desires. And at some point, he turned to me and said, "You have a lot of desires." And that was kind of like a wake-up call. I didn't, you know, I guess I do. I mean, you know, all the things that probably I listed, I couldn't do them in one lifetime, you know. But I thought they were all reasonable. And since then, I've kind of reflected, you know, what was involved with that desire that I had. You know, I was giving him, you know, telling him this litany of desires. And one of the things that was operating there in that conversation in the car was my self-image. And so I had those desires, but those desires were linked to my self-image of who I wanted to, how I wanted to be, who I wanted to show myself to the world, how I was going to represent myself to others. And that gave that desire greater strength. I was trying to build a certain self up. It was certainly a desire for pleasure was operating in some of that. And some of it, just in the conversation, was it was pleasurable for me to kind of get into this fantasy of who I could be. It was great, just the pleasure of it. The imagination, it's a lot easier to imagine yourself as being someone wonderful than it is to be someone, you know, whatever the pursuit you want to pursue. Some of this, some of the things that get hooked onto desire is a desire for security. If, you know, this will provide me security if I have this, it's part of the rationalization process. Now, in looking at desire, sensual desire for comfort. From the point of view of meditation practice or mindfulness practice, there are generally two different avenues of advice of how to work with it, how to deal with it. One has to do with the nature of the object that we are desiring. And the other has to do with the nature of the subject, the person inside, how we are. So sometimes Buddhist texts will talk about looking at the object of desire and looking at its danger, looking how there's problems there, there's difficulties there, or look at its undesirable qualities, undesirable aspects. And so, for example, feeling a desire for food. You've already, you know, had a good meal, and you feel quite content, and there can be a sensual desire for more pleasure. And, you know, that cheesecake, blueberry cheesecake, seems really good that they have on the menu. And then the waiter even comes along and shows it to you. And you feel, just a movement towards desire. It'd be so great to have that, even though you feel content. But if you look at the object and say, well, you know, if I eat more of that, I think I'll get sick. And so you say, well, that desire is a little bit dangerous for me because I'll probably get indigestion, I'll get overly full, I'll get groggy or something if I eat it. So sometimes text talk, you know, look at the object. It's not what it seems to be. It's not going to do for you what you hope, what you're hoping it would do. If you really go out and buy, I mean, almost anything, I can't think of anything at the moment, but you all know the advertisements that have these really sensual people advertising, you know, paper clips. And the assumption, the association is that if you buy this paper clip, you know, you can be one of these kind of, you know, shiny people, you know, beautiful people, you know, and fleshy people. And so there's an association there, and paper clips. You know, what's the association with naked bodies and paper clips? But, you know, and so somehow you realize, if you really think about it, you realize, wait a minute, that's not going to do it for me. Even if I carry the paper clip on my shirt pocket, you know, and show people that I have paper clip, it's not going to do it. So to see somehow the danger, or see some of the problem, or see the superficiality of what we were trying to pursue in the object. The other kind of avenue is to look more at ourselves more deeply. One way to do that is actually turn the attention away from the object and understand what's going on inside of us. One of the things we can understand is that we have misunderstood the object. We're projecting onto the object. We're assuming that the object is different than what it actually is. And we can see that projection operating. And if your mind is really quiet enough and sensitive enough, you can see how the mind conjures up an image, conjures up a projection, a fantasy that is not actually out there in the world. Sometimes you see it after the fact. Sometimes on retreats, the story I've told of having a kind of a sexual attraction to a woman on a retreat, and then realizing at the end of the retreat, when we broke silence and I heard her speak, that she had a French accent. And I realized at that moment my whole fantasy was based on her being an American. And I saw at that moment how much I projected onto this person. The person wasn't what I thought she was. So sometimes we can start seeing the nature of our projection, the nature of how our thinking works. But you have to have a sensitive mind to see that. Sometimes you turn the attention around, and rather than focusing on the object of desire, you focus on what it feels like to be desiring. What does it feel like to be in the grips of desire? The impulse, the leaning forward, the contraction, the sense of thirst, the sense of sometimes I felt desire. The image of a panting dog kind of works for me sometimes, the way desire feels. You know, what does it feel like subjectively? To turn the attention around. And that's one of the ways to take the compelling quality of the desire away. As long as we're focusing on the object, there isn't the kind of presence of mind to counter the compelling force of very strong desire. But if you turn the attention around and look at the compelling nature itself, then sometimes it can lose its grip on us. So that to train ourselves, turn the attention away from the object. Not because the object is bad, but rather to really get to know what's happening inside of us, to feel it within ourselves, to sense it and feel the texture of desire, sensual desire. Sometimes in turning inwards towards ourselves, we have to understand some of the other forces that are linked to that sensual desire. When it can be linked to the drive for security, or linked to the drive to recognition, or linked to the drive to overcome our loneliness or our sadness. Sometimes there are psychological holes or psychological issues that are trying to be fulfilled by pursuing the sensual desire. I like it, you know, the word wanting in English is very nice in this regard, because we can say the soup is wanting salt. And what it means is that soup is lack salt. It needs more salt. Wanting sometimes refers to a feeling of lack and emptiness. Not always, but sometimes. And sometimes desire, when it's a little bit amiss, is trying to fill an emptiness or hole inside of ourselves. So one of the things to do is that when we turn the attention away from the object of desire to feeling ourselves, sometimes we have to feel that place of discomfort inside of ourselves. You're standing in front of the refrigerator for one more piece of cheesecake. And you stop and you say, okay, what's going on here with myself? And you realize, I'm feeling really lonely or sad or empty. And then let me sit on the couch and just sit there and feel that. And feel what it's like. And that's one of the principles of mindfulness, is when we feel some kind of emptiness or discomfort like that, is we figuratively sit down in the middle of the discomfort. Place yourself in the middle of it and feel it and sense it and somehow develop a kind of strength or freedom in the midst of it that can be quite healing of it. So for example, feeling lonely. To place ourselves in the middle of loneliness is to inhabit the loneliness. And loneliness is an activity. And so when we sit ourselves in the middle of it and notice it and feel it, that activity begins to relax. And so, perhaps it goes away. But a wise life, from Buddha's point of view, is one that learns to turn around and really feel honestly what is happening here. So that's another avenue of how to deal with the hindrance of sensual desires, to go and feel the psychological forces that are linked to desire and that are giving it fuel and power. No one's expected not to have sensual desire. This is completely, normal part of human life. But if we're trying to follow through on some deep aspiration, deep wish, like, for example, in meditation, then we need to somehow learn how to overcome its allure. When a person has become familiar with desire and knows it well, then it can be enough just to use mindfulness on it. You feel the desire arising, and you turn your attention to it and say, desire, desire, I see you. Wanting's happening, wanting, wanting. If you can see desire clearly, you're no longer in the grip of it. It might still be there, but you are not the desire anymore. You're not in the grip of it. So we practice mindfulness. Desire, I see you. And we really see it, look at it head on. And seeing it also implies really feeling it in the body. What's a desire like? So really to be clear about it. At some point, as meditation practice deepens, the deep satisfaction of being present, of being settled and concentrated, clearly is more satisfying than any thought, any movement towards sensual pleasure that the mind might want to conjure up to take you away from the present moment. And that's a beautiful moment in practice where you see, where you're really clear, oh, it's so much more satisfying to go in the direction of peace. And it's so clear that it's an easy choice to make. There I go. Desire arises, I just go there. But the mind has to be somewhat settled and pure in order to have that juncture and be able to just choose that so easily. At some point the meditation is strong, there's no tendency for desire to rise at all. Sensual desire to rise. It just no longer has any grip on the psyche at all. It's not going to rise when the concentration is deep. However, as people come out of meditation, out of concentration, sooner or later, the pull for sensual desire will reassert itself and becomes an issue again. And so then, coming back into normal life, then the person needs to learn how to be wise again about how to work with this amazing force that arises on sensual desire. And to be able to see when the pursuit of sensual desire is wise, useful, or appropriate, and when it's not wise, when it's inappropriate, when it actually causes more difficulty for us, keeps us in bondage. And then to learn how to have the strength to choose the appropriate direction to take. Meditation practice, or Buddhist spiritual practice, involves having the capacity to let go. But that capacity to let go, has a lot to do with having some capacity of inner strength. So letting go is not something kind of casual, you know, coming that makes you weaker. There has to be a lot of strength, a strength of character, a strength of force, a strength of intentionality that allows us to follow our aspirations, our deepest wishes, our deepest intentions, so it's not derailed by all kinds of things, including sensual desire. So maybe that's enough. What do you think? It's your turn. If you ever want to ask any questions or comments, yes, please. Right. So, the question is, how does we distinguish between pleasure and happiness? Because sometimes there's a confusion around it. I think that one of the ways to answer that question is to begin studying both of them more carefully, and then in your own experience begin to discern the difference between what is pleasure and what is happiness. My suggestion: essential pleasure has to do with the senses. Pleasure has to do with the senses. Happiness has to do with the heart, with something more deeper inside, and it's not necessarily, you don't identify with a sense door. Even though there might be sensuality with happiness, the happiness itself is something deeper. Yes? If you could please use the mic.
This might sound like a strange question, but I was just imagining eating a piece of chocolate cake when you were talking. And I'm trying to figure
Mark,
out
can
how
you can turn it down a little bit, Mark? You can look too loud, the volume. Because you're holding it. Okay, please.
How I would eat that piece of chocolate cake without feeling a sense of desire in myself. Maybe you could talk about that.
How do you eat it without desire?
How do I eat a piece of chocolate cake without feeling some sense of anticipation or desire for that flavor or the taste of the pleasure that's going to come to me?
Remember that it's okay to have sensual desire. This is not, we're not trying to trash all sensual desire. But we have to have some freedom and wisdom about when to pursue it, when to act in it, and when to be able to pull ourselves apart from it. So, you know, to want to have the pleasure of a chocolate cake, it can be innocent enough if you're, you know, not already stuffed. And so there might be anticipation of the pleasure it brings, and that kind of motivates you, and it could be fine to do that. But also it's possible to have pleasure without having desire. So, so someone puts chocolate cake in front of you and says, please eat this. And so you eat it, and there's no desire particularly for it, but you're eating it, and it's very pleasant. It's very nice to feel. you go out to the beach one day and you see the sunset, and it's very pleasant to see. And you're just enjoying it. There's a lot of enjoyment. But there's no, you know, clinging or no attachment or desire or drive to have more sunset. It's just what's happening. So one of the things for you to do then is to explore next time you have chocolate cake. If you can distinguish between just having the pleasure in and of itself versus wanting more pleasure or wanting the pleasure. I've eaten cake. I've eaten, you know, and I've noticed sometimes where, you know, I'm putting one fork in my mouth. It's in my mouth. I start chewing. And my desire is operating so strongly that I'm already leaning forward to get the next bite and not really noticing the pleasure that's there. So sometimes the desire for sensual pleasure ruins itself because the drive is so strong that we don't even notice the pleasure that's actually happening. So I don't know if that's helpful.
When you answered that other question, you said, well, you know, it's sensual desire when there's some sense gate. And yet in your talk, you said that intellectual desire can be sensual desire. And you talked about, you know, advertising appeals and things. And often those are to ego things or image or status or insecurity and fear, not really to you will feel more sensual pleasure.
Right.
So it strikes me that those things could still very much get in the way of practice. They are a form of desire, but I don't see how they're sensual desire. Right.
Good. So the first one, intellectual pleasure, in mind, Buddhism posits 6 sense doors. And so usually in English we talk about having 5 senses. And so Buddhism posits a 6th one. And the 6th one is that sense, that organ of perception that picks up what goes on in the mind. So that's why there can be, you know, intellectual pleasure, you know, pleasure in the mind. And the second issue about distinguishing desires which have to do with sensual pleasure and desires that have to do with other things. It's possible that I was being sloppy and kind of, you know, bringing into this sensual pleasure thing other forms of desire. But sometimes other things, you know, have at their root sensual desire, even though it might seem like other reasons. But the, what I tried to do in the talk today was to stay true to which I apparently didn't do a very good job at. I tried to stay true to the idea that kamachanda, the first hindrance, is the hindrance of sensual pleasure. Usually when I and other people give talks about the first hindrance, we cover all desires as part of it. So there's a kind of a, sometimes an easy, it's easy to kind of bring in other forms of desire once you start talking about sensual desire. So I was trying to keep it just with sensual pleasure, but I failed, so. That's the way it goes. It's always good to see a Dharma teacher fail. Remember that when it's being taught in Buddhism, when the traditional Buddhist teaching around 5 hindrances have to do with meditation practice, and there's seemingly something about sensual pleasure which becomes a greater hindrance in deep meditation than desire for more abstract things. Because probably more abstract things, you're more easy to let go of to some degree. But even the idea of self-identity, of self-image, kind of falls away as a concern. But there can still be an allure for sensual pleasure in deep meditation. Partly because in deep meditation, meditation itself can be very pleasurable. So it can be kind of like the very thing that's supposed to free you from pleasure brings you so much pleasure that it keeps you cooked to it. Yes? Please, can you wait a moment, please? One of the reasons we use the mic, there's 2 reasons. One is that there's a fair number of people here who use the hearing assistant devices and they can't hear the question unless we use the mic. And the other is that there are a good number of people who listen to these talks on the web, and they won't have a chance to hear the question either. So the people in Mongolia, places like that, will be listening to you.
Now I have stage fright.
I know.
I've noticed, particularly since the results of the election were announced, that I would think, okay, I'm okay with this, I'm dealing with it. Then I realized I'm doing all this incredible nervous eating. And, you know, there's not enough help. You can't even write this down here. And it's almost unconscious.
Yeah.
Very uncomfortable. I really feel very out of control in that way.
Yes.
And a lot of suffering.
I understand. A lot of people like you. I've been talking to people who've been in tears.
Yeah, I'm like right near there right now.
Right.
So, and real problem sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
Because of waking up and, you know, and I, well, at least I'm not getting up in the middle of the night doing a lot of nervous eating. I'm giving it a break in the middle of the night. But I realize, especially like at work, that, you know, there's not enough. And I'm not hungry at all. And I'm eating things I'm not even interested in. Just like to try to calm. And I'm getting it. It's a sensual. It's the nervous system going mm-hmm. after a sensual object to quiet the anxiety and the anger and the feelings that I don't want to do.
Right.
So, thank you.
No. So we should maybe stop the. I've talked to a number of people who've been very distressed about the election, and what I'd like to offer it, so maybe some risk at offering it, but I'd like to offer it, is that when there's really strong reactions, for example, around almost anything, there's also an opportunity there, and it's also a very important one. That we have very strong reactions because of very deep things within ourselves. It's touched something really deep and very important. And it can be a variety of deep things it's touching, some of them which may be beautiful and important, and some of them which might have to represent a certain level of attachment. And the opportunity, when the stronger the reaction is, the greater the opportunity is for self-discovery and to really understand what makes us tick and what makes us work. The suggestion in Buddhism is that the Buddhist practice is that it's not necessary ever to lose our peace. Mahatma Gandhi, who fought the British, seemingly was always at peace. And he was a very effective fighter for independence of India. What is it that causes us, what causes us to lose our touch with some deep abiding sense of well-being and peace? So the greater that we lose that, the greater the, and there's good reasons for feeling a lot of anxiety now, the greater the opportunity is for self-understanding. And so to use this as an opportunity rather, so again, to turn away from the object, at least temporarily in a wise way, to really try to take advantage of this, to really understand the depths of what we're holding inside of our own hearts, what's there. And hopefully in doing that, then all of us can be more effective when we do choose to get involved in the public sphere again, whatever way we want. So I think it's very important what's happened, and I hope that those of you who find it, those of you for whom this is relevant, will find wise avenues of self-discovery at this time. So thank you.